Croeso and welcome to Tales for Wales, the pod that never fails to render your knowledge of Welsh history, to code in the podcast whimsy, to punch that cheat code and unlock the infinite bounce hack that is Wales. I'm Jack, and as always, I'm joined by my trusty player two, Franco. But today, we've dusted off the Wildcats controller and we've plugged in a player three, Stephen, developer of a new game that we feel will pique the interest of our listeners. More on that later. Anyway, how are you all, boys?
Not too bad.
I'm doing very good, thank you.
Do you want to say where you're joining us from, Stephen?
I'm in Canada. I'm in Montreal.
Very cool. I'm joining our first international with my guest.
I was going to say across the pond.
With my drinks ready.
Nice. Oh, that's a good start. What are you drinking?
I hope this is not too heretical. I'm actually drinking a Scottish whiskey.
Oh, no, they're our Celtic brothers. We're happy with
that. I would say Celtic brethren. We're all right with that, yeah.
Yeah. What kind of whiskey is it? Do you know the name?
It's called Ardbeg.
Me and Jack
That's all I know about it.
We're not very sophisticated by any means.
We're not very au fait with whiskey.
I got this out specially for you guys, Hannah. I don't usually drink this fancy, huh?
No, we're usually the kind of guys, you know, where they go, you say like, oh, yeah, if someone's like, oh, this is a really fancy whiskey, it's, it's 10 years age, it's just like, cool, we'll have it with Coke, mate, yeah. That's all right, you can just dilute it.
Well, do you have good whiskey in Wales?
Yeah, surprisingly, there's a really big one called Pendedin, which is based up in Brecon, and it's become like bigger and bigger and bigger, and like Welsh whiskey for ages was just not a thing, but like Pendedin is probably the main standout one, and then there's some smaller offshoots of whiskey, but that's like the main bulk of it, isn't it? The big Pendedin.
Welsh spirits in general, they're sort of gaining a lot of traction at the moment. You know, there's Welsh gin, there's Welsh rum, there's all sorts of stuff coming out, and you know that 10 years ago it was nada, you had nothing. But Pendedin, that's probably been going. That's probably one of the most famous ones, I'd say, isn't it?
It's a great one to get your father-in-law as well, isn't it? It's like a classic.
Oh, 100%, yeah. Easy gift at Christmas.
Yeah. I got 4 more days of dry January, and I cannot believe how long this month has taken me. But I'm having a delicious glass of Pepsi Max to tide me over. But I'm sure you'll be doing better.
Have you heard this, Stephen? That he's at the moment he's being so like puritanical that he won't even drink like caffeinated Coke in the day. He saves that as a treat for the night. Like, ooh, cheeky, along with a caffeinated Coke.
I've lost a stone because I'm not drinking, which just shows the how bad for you alcohol is. But I've got 4 more days until I reverse all my good work and get back on it. But yeah, until then, a delicious Pepsi Max. What are you drinking, Jack?
I'm on the Bud Light at the moment, but I have got I've joined you, Stephen, on the fancy stuff. I've got a Kraken Black Spice Rum with dark caramel and Cornish sea salt. So I'm also on the Celtic Brethren brews here.
Nice.
The Cornish element. It's already halfway drunk because I just can't help myself. That's from a different time. I haven't done that today. But yeah, looking forward to that later. I'm just on the light stuff because I basically said I wasn't going to drink beer for January. Like, I'd keep to the spirits if I had to. And then that's just gone out the window, just completely and utterly. So now I've just gone, if it's a Bud Light, that's basically good for you, isn't
Pretty
it?
Much
that's
a healthy. Salad.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Does it even count as beer?
No, it's just pond water.
As we say, piss water all the time. That's as we say.
Well, you might be wondering who this third voice is and why he's come on. Because I'm sure most people who follow us will probably know, saw it in the news. It was covered by the BBC. It was all over Reddit. There was loads of channels picked it up. But Stephen's developing a Welsh game, a game based on Welsh mythology on the Mabinogion. So we reached out to him and asked if he'd come and spare a bit of time and talk us through it, because as you all know, me and Jack are big into our games and the Mabinogion. So we were really interested by this, and he kindly said yes. So we got a couple of questions to go through with you, if you're happy to share a bit of insight into what's coming with the game.
For sure, fire away.
Jack, do you want to start?
I'll fire away. So First up, what's your background in terms of game design and creation? I'm sorry, I stumbled at the first hurdle by messing. What background is games? Yeah, sorry. What's your background in terms of game design / creation?
So I started my first job, kind of working with games, was right back in the mid 90s. Now, My first job was working as a writer for Games Workshop. That's so cool. Makers of Warhammer and Warhammer 40K and all that.
Oh man, you were just describing like ultimate job when I was a teenager. Like I was like, this is what I'm going to get into.
Yeah. For me too, cool. As well. At least for the first like year or so, that's what it was like. Mm. And then I kind of transitioned from there into video games with Warhammer Online. So Warhammer Online was my first video game, and the transition there just because, you know, the Warhammer stuff. And, there were a bunch of people from the studio, from the Games Workshop studio that went to work on Warhammer Online. And then just kind of stayed in video games from there. So I worked for a bunch of smaller companies. This was back in the UK. I moved over to France for a little while and worked for some smaller developers in France as well.
So you've been all over, mate.
Yeah. And then moved to Canada 15 years ago now. To go and work for Ubisoft. So most of the past 15 years has been in AAA. So I've worked on like a lot of the big licenses, a couple of Assassin's Creed titles and For Honor, you know, that kind of samurai.
Man,
Viking,
you're throwing Viking. These names around as if it's not a big deal. Me, I can tell me and Frank's are like, Assassin's Creed, we love those games.
And just because, some of our listeners might not be aware, but if you're not into games, AAA means like the Hollywood of gaming. It's like the top tier. And the Assassin's Creed franchise is one of the biggest. And it's got quite a lot of references to Welsh things in it, especially Black Flag.
I think we've covered that as well, haven't we? In Assassin's Creed Valhalla, there's a lot of Welsh nods and overt references, actually. I think King Rodri's in it, isn't he?
Yeah. I put 300 hours into that game, which is an insane amount of hours to play it, but I absolutely loved it. This is crazy to have someone of your caliber join us, rapscallions.
And then that led up to, 2023, 2 years ago, I kind of packed all that in and decided to quit AAA and do my own thing. And that kind
back
of...
Back to grassroots, mate. I like it.
Yeah, brings us to where we are now.
Sorry, I was taking a massive swig of my drink.
I can tell. I can hear it swishing about your mouth.
You could hear me gulping it down. Yeah, sorry.
I'm doing exactly the same thing.
So how come you sort of wanted to make that transition back to... this is. I'm going off script.
I was
going to
say this
gonna
is
losing
off-piss.
His mind. He's like, "This is not a question I've sent.
Not a prescribed question.
This is not. Has not been the double stamp, triple approval. But I just wanted to ask. So, what? Why did you, out of personal interest, now switch back to like the smaller scale stuff?
I think. I mean, at the time, I'd been doing AAA for 13 years, and that's a long time to do anything, huh?
Yeah,
that's true.
And especially in the AAA industry, it's. I mean, it gets to be super frustrating. You know, it's very cyclical. You do the same kind of project over and over again. Over and over again, you see the same people making the same mistakes. Mm. You get the same frustrations over and over again. And just, you know, I'd kind of had enough of that. And at the same time, this was kind of like coming out of the pandemic. Mm. And the AAA industry was having a lot of problems, or it still is, you know, the past couple of years. There are a lot of redundancies, a lot of projects closing down. So, you know, I left Ubisoft, and right after leaving Ubi, they laid off a whole bunch of people. I went to Eidos, who make Tomb Raider, Deus Ex, things. Eidos, just after I didn't stay there very long, laid off a whole bunch of people as well right after I left. So the state of the AAA industry was just not feeling very, you know, bright and shiny. So a couple of those two things together, kind of like my fatigue with just doing it for too long and the industry clearly like starting to have troubles kind of combined together to a...
I can imagine that should be very inspiring if everyone's getting fired. And like you said, AAA is not in the best health at the moment, is it? So I imagine it can be quite disheartening if studios are closing, poor decisions are being made. So it makes sense if you're going to give it your own go.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair play. Well, I'll get back on script now.
Yes, right back on script.
Sorry, yeah. I sent you the pre-approved questions. So, next one up. So, how come you picked the Mabinogion as your subject, and how did you decide which stories to focus on? And just for maybe some listeners who aren't aware, Mabinogion is like the Welsh book of myths and legends, essentially.
Yeah. So really big questions there. I'll start with how did I pick the Mabinogion. This is going to be a long answer, okay, so be prepared.
We got time, mate.
So this was 2023. I decided I was going to do my own thing. But then, I need to work out what is my own thing. Like, what is it that I want to do? And while I was thinking about this question, a couple things happened, like, at exactly the same time. So the first of these things was I discovered the Mabinogion. Like, I hadn't heard of it before. I kind of decided I wanted to do a fantasy narrative for my first, kind of independent game. But fantasy is a really hard genre to do, right? It's like, it's super oversaturated. It's way overdone. It's hard to find the kind of interesting original angle to take.
Definitely.
So what I was doing is I was looking into the history of fantasy literature to try and kind of find some inspiration. So I was looking at the history of Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones and Harry Potter and Dungeons and Dragons, like the narratives behind Dungeons and Dragons, and looking at all these kind of, the history of all these kind of different narratives. I kept coming to this one book that just kept popping up in all this kind of, these different like historical trails, which was the Mabinogion. So it was like, okay, this is interesting.
Yeah, it's got to be like, something here if they all roads lead to the Mabinogion.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm so happy that that's how it comes to you, that all these things lead back to it. Because we think personally it doesn't get much coverage, so it's nice to hear that it does kind of reach people.
That was exactly the question. It was kind of like, why does this not get more coverage? I got a copy and I read it, and it was mind-blowing. It was like... Every single trope from fantasy literature, from contemporary fantasy literature, it's there, like written 1,000 years ago, almost 1,000 years ago. It has dragons and wizards and magic swords and rings of invisibility and battles against armies of undead, and it's all there. And nobody knows about it. Well, obviously people in Wales know about it, and kind of academic circles, they know about it, but like the global population just isn't aware.
Definitely. You hear it here first, folks. The fantasy genre has its origins in Wales. It's been said by Stephen, just there, confirmed. Okay,
yeah, that's how it is. Really, really. Whatever academics may say, and like, well, that was certainly my perception of it as I was reading it for the first time. And then this opens the question of, like, we were just saying, why is this not more well known? So the exact same time that this was happening, that I was kind of discovering the Mabinogion and starting to ask these questions about why it's not more well-recognized, I was doing a project with my youngest daughter at school. She was 7 at the time. So we're doing a project on family. So we were building this family tree, and was in contact with all the older relatives, all great uncles and great aunts.
Yeah, go back as far as you can type thing.
Yeah. And they were all sending over photos and newspaper articles and all kinds of stuff. While we were looking through all of these, I started finding things in Welsh, like bags of photos. They had like descriptions of what was happening in the photo, and it was written in Welsh, and newspaper clippings in Welsh. And it's so... I've always known there's a Welsh connection in my family, right? My mum's name is Bronwyn. My grand's name is Gwen. She was Gwen Jones, right?
If you've got classic, beautiful Welsh name. Beautiful Welsh name.
Yeah. So when you have a granny Gwen Jones in the family, there's Welsh heritage there, right? But despite that, no one in the family ever identified as Welsh in any way. It was very firmly a British family. Certainly never heard anyone speak any Welsh.
Yeah.
But the Welsh language was, it was recent. It was like just back to my grandparents' generation.
Yeah, not too long ago then.
Yeah, so it's kind of like okay, yeah, this is strange. How come I never knew that my family ancestry was, you know, a Welsh-speaking family of Welsh nationals?
So just when, as you were finding about the Mabinogion, you found out your ties to Welsh heritage as well. It was meant to be, mate. The Celtic gods had looked upon you.
That was exactly it. It was like when those two things came together at exactly the same time and exactly the time I was looking for a narrative for the game, it's like, okay, I know what I need to do now. Partly...
You are the Welsh Messiah. That's what you felt. I am the Welsh Messiah.
Yeah, that's the exact words that went through my head. partly it's to kind of like try and bring a little bit of exposure to the stories. But partly also to kind of like pay respect to my ancestors, right? You know, pay respect to... here's an interesting one. I found out my great-great-great-grandfather was a guy called Seth Roberts from Brembo. And he was the first person to ever sing the Welsh national anthem in North Wales. And I was kind of like, when I found that, it's like, why does no one tell these kind of stories anymore? Yeah. You know? Why do people... And part of the reason was kind of like reconnect with that ancestry. And, you know, so that if great-great-great-grandfather of Seth Roberts is looking down on us, he can be a little bit satisfied.
Yeah,
with
that's so cool, man. You're hitting like all the buzzwords me and Frank's
we absolutely love.
Yeah. You know, like the connection to the past, like exposing Welsh and Welshness and Wales to like a wider audience. Because like part of the reason we, you know, did this podcast is because a lot of these stories, the history stuff, it's just not taught. It's not, you know, no one knows about it really, unless you go deliberately looking for it. So the fact you're sort of, you're in the gang, mate, you're in the Welsh exposure gang. I love it.
It's why we started. I think we used to say quite a lot, we want to shine a light on an otherwise dimly lit, like history or something like that. That used to be a bit of a buzzword we used to say, because it does feel like there's so much history and links to Welsh stuff that is often kind of just locked over and not massively recognised. So, yeah, we were so excited to hear you doing this game.
No, man, that's sick that you got, the fact that those two things came to you at the same time as well is just, well, like I said, it's serendipitous, mate.
Yeah. So, yeah, there was the other part of the question as well, the...
what stories?
Choosing which stories to focus on. And that's a big question on its own as well. So I think... obviously, the Mabinogion, for people that don't know it, is a big collection of vastly different stories, right? And some of the stories are like, they stand completely independent. Some of them have like different levels of ties with other stories.
Yeah, there's different characters, isn't it, that sort of come and repeat. Yeah. And then there's other ones where it's just very much in its own bubble. And I would say, as much as I love the Mabinogion, I don't qualify it as the most accessible piece of literature. I think it really... throws you into it
it's not
at the deep end. You know, you're just meant to understand that, there's a, you know, a herd of unicorns running across the field over there. They don't explain why that happens. It just, you just got to get involved with it.
It does take some work to really get into it. I mean, the first time I read it, like, I had the commentary next to me and I was like going through page by page with the commentary. When I first decided I was going to do something with Mabinogion, the very first iteration was actually going to be an Arthurian, like an Arthurian tale.
Okay.
Because of course the Mabinogion is some of the earliest mentions of King Arthur. And so the logic at that point was, well, not a lot of people have heard of the Mabinogion, but people have heard of King Arthur. So, you know, maybe I can engage people by saying, you know, it's the story of King Arthur.
Yeah, that's an easy draw, isn't it? That almost everyone knows King Arthur.
Yeah. But then partly, even though King Arthur is present in a lot of the stories, he never really does very much. He's more just kind of like part of the backdrop.
Yeah, he's a periphery character at best in a lot of stuff. It's usually like... the heroes of the stories are related to him, you know, distantly or something, and they go to him for help, and he kind of just comes along for the ride, doesn't he, in a lot of them.
Yeah, exactly. So it didn't feel like that was really doing justice to the stories to use King Arthur. Plus, I thought it might be a little bit confusing because, like, the contemporary Arthurian mythology is so based around this kind of more recent, you know, very romanticized and very Anglo-centric version of Arthur.
Definitely.
I didn't know that was kind of translate very well. So ultimately I ended up, well, focusing first of all on the four branches of the Mabinogi. That was kind of like the first cut down. So again, for people that don't know the book well, the stories is very kind of a different range of stories, but there are four that tie together and they kind of run together sequentially, which are, they're referred to as the four branches of the Mabinogi.
That's right, yeah.
And then there it was cutting down to like, what do I want to do with those? And bounced around a few possibilities and ended up deciding on focusing on Pradelli.
Great choice, was, mate. Great choice.
Yeah, he's the one character and the only character that appears in all four branches. So he kind of like feels like a natural choice.
Yeah, and then definitely.
I was actually reading an academic piece, which this is not kind of widely accepted academia, by the way, so don't start, you know, saying that this is...
Oh, mate, we're not sticklers for accuracy on this podcast. Don't you worry. You could say anything right now. We go, oh, yeah, nice one.
That's stories, so don't we? We're stories.
Yeah. So this article that's saying Pradelli was actually a ninja pirate and that he fought against an army of robots.
I knew it. I always had my suspicions.
I thought, that's going to make a great video game.
Yeah, I was going to say, if that's what you've gone with, I'm there, man, day one.
No, so it was saying that, or speculating that the four branches of the Mabinogi might originally have been like as a one single coherent epic as the life of Pradelli.
Yeah.
So of course the first branch starts with his birth and then you have his death in the last branch. Spoiler alert, sorry.
Yeah. It's 1,000 years old. Don't at us, okay? it's been out for a while.
Yeah, that's fair enough, huh? Then it was focusing on the story of Pradelli in the context of, well, finally in the context mostly of the third branch. We'd also look a lot at the first branch and a little tiny bit that some of the stories are from the second branch.
Next one. You mentioned earlier you found a bit of Welsh in your ancestry, sort of Welsh newspaper clippings and notes and things like that on pictures. Does the role of the Welsh language play a part in the game?
Oh, yes, of course. I should have mentioned before. Like, the game is in Welsh.
Oh, it's all in Welsh?
Yeah, fully in Welsh with English subtitles.
Ding, ding, ding. You've hit the jackpot with us, yeah.
And I think it didn't take long once I decided I was going to do, or I was going to use the Mabinogian as the central narrative. It didn't take long to come to the conclusion that the only authentic and respectful way to treat that is to do it in Welsh, right? Which was obviously going to be a big challenge because at the time I did not speak any Welsh at all.
It's a tough language to get into as well, apparently. Like, for, you know, we're lucky we learn it from young when you're like a sponge and you take it all in type
but
thing.
But even then, it's still quite hard to, you know, we're not.
It is a bit tough. It's so very different. It's so very different from English, you know, so many different rules and things that you just don't have to think about in English.
Yeah, you know, honestly, as a language, like, I haven't found it that hard as a language. I mean, it has its particularities, you know, the mutations and the 3,000 different ways of saying yes and no.
yeah, that's true.
It has its, like, little oddities, but I haven't found it that. What's really hard is just finding resources, you know, finding opportunities to use it and finding kind of learning resources. You know,
I imagine there's not a huge kind of Welsh education resource in Canada, is there? I mean, I don't know. Maybe there is, but
there's a Montreal Welsh male voice choir.
Oh, wow.
that sings in Welsh. That's literally the only Welsh speaking group I found, nearby.
I think the Eisteddfod, the North American Eisteddfod. Fluctuates between being in Canada and in and parts of America. I think every so often, every fourth year, it's in Canada.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can show you the info of that after.
Yeah. I will have to find out about that. The whole game is written in Welsh.
That's so cool.
Narrated in Welsh.
Oh, amazing!
I think it kind of Welsh is it. you know, it's the language that Tolkien used as the basis for his Elvish language. I think there's a very good reason for that, which is that Welsh does have this kind of like musical, magical tone to it. So I think if you want to tell a fantasy story, Welsh is just a great choice, you know, regardless of
it's already the kind of primed like for it, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
I always say this, Franks is from a place called Dinas Powys, and I always think Minas Tirith from Lord of the Rings, Dinas Powys. I mean, come on, those are pretty, pretty similar. Do you need any more evidence than that? Come on.
And Mordor is in Mid Wales as an actual place.
So, oh, nice.
Yeah, so I think his nan, or his auntie, or his, I think it was his nan who was from Wales, and he had a massive love for Wales. So, yeah, he named a lot of the name places after Welsh towns.
Yeah, it wasn't a slam on Mid Wales. Like, oh, what's the shittest place I can think of? Mordor in Mid Wales.
Yeah. What's the next one, Jack? You ready? Have you got it lined
up? Yes, sorry. I'm unlocking my phone again. All right, sorry. Not bloody perfect. So, yes, apologies if this is a bit reductive, but could you compare it to any other game that you know of to sort of help give our listeners a kind of sense of what kind of game they'd be in for if they were playing it?
Right, so it's a narrative environmental exploration game. It's what some people in the industry would kind of refer to as a walking sim, term that I really hate, but you know that's what, what people say. The single, if there was one reference I would pull out, it would be Firewatch. You guys heard of that one?
Yeah, I have.
He is frantically Googling now.
No, I was trying to see if we can put a link into it. I would be pretty poor at describing it, but it's, it does actually look quite similar.
Oh, I have seen. I've just started up. I have seen this pop up on PS Plus.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was on, I haven't played it though, but I have seen it and I heard it. I think it was on an old, not the modern Xbox, but the old one. But yeah, do you want to describe how it's similar to Firewatch?
So the high level gameplay loop is you're in the wilderness of ancient Wales. You're wandering around, you go from story point to story point, and at each story point you uncover a little nugget of narrative.
Okay.
So that's basically the same thing that happens in Firewatch. You know, in Firewatch, you're exploring around the forests of some place in the United States, and you're unlocking stories of what's been happening in the forest. The game is not a pure walking sim. So even though it's inspired by games like Firewatch or Dear Esther, if you've heard of Dear Esther.
Oh, I have heard of that. Yeah, I've heard of that one.
It's inspired by those kinds of games. It's not a strict walking sim. So there are other gameplay loops that come in as well. There's a fog gameplay where you have this kind of like cursed magical fog that chases you around the landscape. There's a tracking gameplay like you'd find in something like The Witcher or even some Assassin's Creed titles.
Predary, Great Hunter, on brand. Mm-hmm. I like it.
Indeed. There's a little bit of combat. The combat is very light though. The whole purpose of the game is to tell a story, right? It's about experiencing something rather than about challenging the player. So the combat, there's no like health system, there's no player death, there's no fail state at all. In fact, it's just about creating the narrative.
Well, that sounds like a great way to kind of experience a Mabinogion story, you know, in like discovering it yourself. Like going around in a kind of, like you say, an explorative kind of medium, rather than sort of reading it on a book. As good as that is, this sounds like a great way to sort of go through it.
It's not the most easily accessible thing to get into, and it's quite daunting. So if you get given a way of hearing that story, because there is no other way, you know, what Stefan's doing or Stephen's doing is incredibly unique. Like, there isn't any... there's a few modern versions of books for the Mabinogion, which like retell the stories. Yeah. But if they're quite child friendly and they're not really aimed at adults massively. And I think this makes it such an inclusive way of hearing a story without having to like, you know, get a massive film studio to make a story about it. This is you getting to involve. So I think that's really cool.
Because the stories are begging for like adaptations, you know?
Absolutely.
And I think there was like an animated series back in like, maybe the 2000s was the last thing I can remember that maybe tried to do Mabinogion. I think I had Johan Griffith in it. But apart from that, you can't, and they're so fantastical. You can't just do like a cheap budget thing, really, can you? It's got to be done in a kind of really
immersive,
creative way, an immersive way. So yeah, I think you're onto something there, right?
I hope so. I hope so. Actually, there's one kind of really interesting reference. This is not a video game reference at all, but an interesting reference that came up recently. So I've been watching a lot of Esperber Ek recently. Do you guys know this is the Welsh language TV channel?
Yeah.
Do you guys know the show Amdro?
Yeah. We had a guest, one of our previous guests has been on that show, Dr. Kamarik.
Oh, yes. I watch his videos.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's very good. He's like the perfect guy for that as well, because he's just so good at, like, you're saying about, you know, exposure for Wales and the Welsh language. He's like all about that. So he was like, you know, fit so well.
He was great to talk to.
So I was watching Amdro, and I was thinking, you know, they're walking around the mountains and forests and castles and coastlines of Wales and telling stories about Wales. And it's like, that's kind of what my game is. So it's kind of, it's
Amdro,
like Amdro,
the game.
But,
I love it.
Yes, but it's kind of like part Amdro and then part, you know, The Witcher or Assassin's Creed. So it's kind of, you know, mix a bit of Amdro with a bit of The Witcher, and you have the game there.
Mate, that's amazing. That sounds fucking sick. Yeah. Sorry, hyperbole. I've had a couple of drinks. Right, last of my questions, Franks will be glad to know, so you can do it properly after I'm done. You've sort of answered this already, but do you see this game as a way to introduce new audiences to Welsh mythology? And what feedback have you received from people unfamiliar with the Mabinogion so far?
So far, the response to the game has just been overwhelmingly positive from everyone. Like, obviously, from people in Wales and people who speak Welsh and who know the Mabinogion, they've been really excited and interested in it. But people outside as well, I think there is a big community of gamers who are into kind of artsy, narrative-driven games. And not a huge amount of artsy, narrative-driven games that get made for that kind of subsection of the gamer community.
Yeah.
So they're interested just, you know, when there's something there. And the more innovative it is, the more there is new there, the more they're interested in it.
Definitely. I played recently, I finished Disco Elysium.
And,
That is so, like, there's no combat in that. There's no, you know, anything. It's sort of, as you mentioned, it's not your what you consider a typical game. It's all about story, lots of reading, lots of, like, just discovering the world and things like that. And it was brilliant. I thought it was really, really good. One of the better games I've played in a long time. And, there's a lot to be said about these kind of narrative-driven like I said, discovery games, they really are something.
I'm stuck on what to play at the moment. So I've been playing Red Dead Redemption again. And I've just been getting on my horse and going for walks and putting on music in the background and just exploring the nature and reading all the little notes and stuff. And I'm not even doing the game. I'm literally just walking around and, like, involving myself in the world it creates. So I think there is a big want for that.
Vibing. That's what it's about, lads.
Exactly. I mean, that's part of kind of like one of the high level descriptions, one of the kind of like summaries that I made at the very start when I began. This was it's a game about what you feel, not about what you do. You know, it's about creating that experience for the players.
That's a good little pitch there, mate. That's a good little synopsis. That's a gold. That is marketing gold.
And then there's a last kind of group of people who've been like really interested and really, you know, excited about it is kind of wider folklore community. So there is kind of, I was concerned it would be a little bit of a touchy subject because, you know, there are a lot of people that are very attached to the text. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who can, it's literally a sacred text for some people. So it's always, you know, you got to be a little bit careful when you're stepping into that kind of territory.
But like the things that are that old and sort of culturally significant, there's a lot of like purists, isn't there, who don't like a kind of or maybe not that keen on like a retelling or something that's like an adaption rather than a word for word retelling. I get what you mean.
So that was, I mean, that was my concern anyway, but really not at all, or very, very little. I think the only times it has come up, I think, is people that just haven't really understood what I'm trying to do. You know, I think there are people that they hear video game and what they think is like, you know, pew pew, yo bro.
The what was it, the like pirate, their... the pirate ninja robot?
yeah, exactly, right. And they kind of immediately jump to that kind of conclusion that that's what's going to be done with it. And so that's, you know, it's a little bit frustrating when those comments come up, but it's really very uncommon. The huge majority of the folklore community have been super receptive and super supportive and super helpful as well, you know, helping me learn about things myself.
We found during this pod that a very passionate audience is the folklore. And the revival of interest in folklore. Like, we have, every time we do a Welsh mythology episode, it's like our highest downloaded episode, and people actively search. They come across our podcast because they've been searching those terms, like Welsh mythology. We've commented a bunch of times that that revival is like, it's really current. And I'm not sure if you get access to the BBC in Canada, but there's a really good show by a guy called Charlie Cooper, who's like, who's did a mockumentary called This Country, and it's a really funny mockumentary about life in Southern England. But he did a spin-off called Myth Country, and he did an episode around finding stuff to do with King Arthur, and bases it, and he meets people who are really into the Mabinogion. I'm not sure if you get access to it, but if you could, I think you'd really enjoy that. It's really funny, and it covers some stuff that you cover.
Yes, that's super interesting. We don't usually get access to BBC, but probably I can find a way.
You probably will find some ways around it.
sailing the high seas if you need to, mate. You know, we're not against it on here. Don't you worry. We'll dob you in.
So you mentioned then working with some folk people who helped give you some resources and stuff. Did you work with any specific like Welsh historians, or was it mostly your own research? Or like, how did you learn more about these stories?
So I have a buddy who's, he's not Welsh, he's Canadian, but he's a professor of medieval literature. Oh, nice. So he's kind of like, he's sometimes my starting point for, you know, when I have questions or when I want to kind of explore the academic side more. You know, he sends over references and things. There's also more and more, I'm just, you know, I'm on like Facebook groups and Discord and Reddit and different forums for Welsh language and Welsh culture and Welsh gamers. When I have questions or I need clarification, I just want to get feedback, I post on those. I'm kind of slowly building up a little circle of contacts that I, you know, bounce ideas off. Nice. But there is a lot of research that I had to do myself. Right? I mean, you can't offload everything onto other people. There's a lot of work that had to go into not just the text, but also, you know, Welsh history and Welsh ecology and geography and you know, all kinds of different aspects that go into that.
Oh yeah, that's a thing I hadn't even considered, is because you're sort of rendering an environment as well to set the game in. Of course, you'd need to look at kind of the topography of Wales back then, you know, whatever it was, 1,000 years ago. Because we've talked about it a bit before, but you know, people look at Wales now and it's this, you know, lovely green country and everything, but mainly rolling hills and grass and all that sort of stuff. But we actually were covered in trees, you know, way back when.
Forests,
ancient rainforests,
exactly,
before it was all cut down. So yeah, that's something I hadn't even thought about. Actually, you'd have to look into that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and because of course a lot of the forest that's left in Wales now is, it's very new, kind of less than 100 years sort of new. You know, you have to search a little bit to find those remaining fragments of the ancient oak woods and the, you know, those old, you know, Celtic Atlantic rainforests.
Yeah, definitely. It's mainly these, like you said, these days it's all trees planted in a row, if that makes sense.
Crop
forests, you know, where they're literally planted to be harvested. Like you said, those ancient woodlands, they're few and far between.
Well, they were chopped down by Edward I when he partly to fuel his war machine, but also to stop the Welsh from hiding in them during his conquest in the 1200s. So the huge amount of our forests in mid and north Wales were just chopped, like literally just destroyed, so we couldn't hide in them.
So even used to love fighting in the forest, didn't we?
Yeah, that was our main guerrilla tactic.
You can't see it, but I'm waving my fist in the air at the English moment.
Good man.
Grimacing like Captain Kirk.
Yeah, Edward.
I find the next question. So what challenges do you face translating the Mabinogion's poetic and like complex narratives into a game? Because I imagine that must have been quite difficult.
Yeah, so I mean, the first question we already talked about a little bit was finding this central character. Mm. I think as a game, I wanted there to be like a single character, someone that the player is, right? Someone that you are when you play the game. So that was the first kind of challenge, was identifying who that would be and how to construct a narrative around that person. A lot of the narrative lends itself fairly easily to video games, especially these kind of narrative driven design that we see in video games now. Like I was saying at the start, there are so many fantasy tropes, fantasy literature tropes in the game. Mm. And fantasy literature is such a staple of video games that it's quite easy to find references for specific things there. I suppose that what the question was.
I suppose that doesn't make
sense. What was the question
again? So it was, what challenges did you face in translating the map?
Challenges, yes, of course.
You're on the too much of the Celtic bloody whiskey already, haven't you, mate?
I think, because you mentioned it's storytelling, I suppose that does translate quite literally and fits in with a game like this, and because you are telling a story, so you can use people. But was there anything that you found that you had to leave out because maybe it just didn't quite work in a game setting?
So I think the limitations that came in there, the real constraints, were less kind of game design constraints and more game production constraints.
Okay.
I'm a micro studio. I'm working on a very limited budget. I'm not able to do things like big battles or giant monsters or things like that. So it's really trying to find like a minimalist narrative. And kind of very conveniently, I found that in the third branch of the Mabinogion. So, in the third branch, what happens is, there's this big war in Ireland at the end of the second branch, and almost everyone gets killed, and there's just a handful of survivors come back.
That's right.
And as they get back, there's this magical fog that settles over the land and just devastates everything. And there's no more people, there's no more buildings fall to ruins, there's no animals, which is narratively super powerful, but also very convenient from a production point of view, because it just means you don't have to make a lot of stuff, right?
Oh, of course, yeah. Just put the fog in. You don't have to render anything.
Yeah,
this is
exactly.
Great. Yeah.
I think it was kind of just convenient that I was able to take the third branch of the third branch of the Mabinogion there and kind of build a narrative centered around that. So that was kind of like that was a bigger constraint than any kind of design constraints. Mm-hmm. I think the other big sort of not really constraint, but modern day video games are a very visual medium, right? So I think there's a big kind of question there. There was a lot of research into finding what the visual identity of the game should be.
Hmm.
And I knew I didn't want to do something realistic. I don't want to have like realistic rendering, partly because it's really hard to do well. But even more than that, because the Mabinogion is, it's fiction, right? It's these legends and myths. It's things that were not reality and were never presented as reality. So I think when you have that kind of narrative, it doesn't necessarily make sense to try and give it a realistic treatment. You need to give it a kind of like artistic treatment, something
that's kind of otherworldly sort of vibe.
Yeah,
to it.
Exactly. So there was a lot of work to try and find that visual identity before settling on this kind of, you know, painterly style, this kind of, you know, impressionist, post-impressionist kind of influenced visual style that I settled on in the end. But that hopefully it does capture some of this kind of, you know, otherworldly feel.
Well, it looks great, mate. Like, yeah. we spotted your game actually before we saw it in Wales Online and things like that, and saw it popping up in sort of news outlets and whatever. And yeah, the art style you've gone with is I think it's perfect for what you're trying to convey and the Mabinogion itself, because it is that kind of, it's almost like a moving painting, you know, it looks great.
And if you're happy, we can put some of these on our Insta so people can check them out, but we'll also put links in the bio. So if you listen to this, search the links in this episode so you can go, we'll direct them to your Reddit post, should we? Or your website.
Or Steam, which is the best way to go?
Steam page would be my top choice.
Good idea, yeah.
Steam, we'll do Steam, yeah. No problem.
So, yeah, we'll link to your Steam from this, the chat notes here. And this is kind of I was trying to think of... sorry, I've just lost my notes. Let me come back in.
It's not well, easy. Well, well.
Okay, so what's your favourite element of the game? So that could be like maybe a specific location or game mechanic, or if that's too definitive of a question, what's one of your favourite elements? If you don't have a favorite yet.
So usually what happens is my favorite is whatever I happen to be working on at the moment. Yeah. So, you know, this week I'm working on, there's the scene from the third branch where Pradari is, there's like a boar that he's chasing after and going deeper into the forest, chasing after this boar. And then he emerges in front of this kind of magical castle that's never been there before. So that's the scene I've been working on this week. So I'm really into that at the moment. I think that's really turning up well.
I bet looks class in your art style as well, to be fair.
Yeah, it's getting there. Still needs some work, but it's getting there.
I like it. He's humble. He's not patting himself on the back too much. He's going, eh, it's all right.
Yeah, we'll see. Like when the game launches, if it has, you know, a lot of success, then I'll pat myself on the back.
Yeah.
Overall, I would say there's a couple things that I really love that really excite me. The first is the whole audio of the game, like everything to do with the audio from the voiceover. So I have this guy, Phil Rowe. He's an award-winning voiceover artist who's doing all the, you know, the voice of Pradari. And he has this, you know, just wonderful musical rich voice that I adore listening to. So, you know, I adore that. The music, I have a guy, I can't remember his family name. Ollie Wilson-Dixon, who's been doing the music. He's, you know, he's a very established Welsh folk musician. And his music is just, I love it again. You know, it's absolutely beautiful, really engages with the atmosphere. And my absolute favorite thing with the audio, though, I'm going to pick on one little thing. Which is the sound effect that we use for the fog. So we did something really interesting here. Like the fog is a really central ingredient to the game, so I wanted to do something a bit kind of, you know, more involved with it. What we did was we took a poem by Taliesin, and we got Phil recorded a few lines from the Taliesin poem, but he did it in like a variety of kind of really sinister voices. So there's kind of like a really kind of sinister whispering sound and the kind of demonic growl. And then we took those different recordings and layered some of these together with a bit of, you know, reverb and other effects. And then layered some kind of like crackling sounds, like a big creature moving through the forest or burning embers. Layered that on top, layered in a kind of like ghostly whistling as well. And ended up with just what I think is a wonderful effect. That's my single favorite little thing.
I can't wait for this game. It's so
I'm literally logging into Steam now. I'm adding it. I'm adding it to my wish list so I can get it as soon as I can.
Nice. One other thing that I really love as well, though, which is the writing. Because, of course, I would love to have written it myself, but I can't, partly because I don't speak Welsh, but also because my writing is not, you know, I don't have confidence in my own writing to give it a good treatment. But I'm very fortunate to have like a little writing team that I'm working with. I have a guy, Gav Thorpe, who's a New York Times bestselling author. He's winner of the Gemmell Prize for Fantasy Literature, which is like one of the most prestigious fantasy writing prizes. You know, it's up there with other winners like Brandon Sanderson. And
I was going to say, you've got quite the pedigree, mate, working on this. This is impressive.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get together, huh? So Gab is working on the English version of the text. And then I have Rhys Yorworth, who is he's an Eisteddfod Crown winner. I think he's an Eisteddfod Chair winner as well. I think he's won them both. But Rhys has been working on the English, the Welsh version of the text. And, you know, sometimes I'll just be reading through it and just lines will pop out that are just beautifully well written. So that's my other favorite thing alongside the audio was the writing that Gavin and Rhys are delivering.
That's cool. Mate, it sounds, you're selling it so well to us. Like me and Frank, so I can just tell when it comes out, we are going to be messaging saying, right, where are you up to on it? Yeah. No spoilers.
Are there any specific real world locations players might recognize then, seeing this is a game based on Wales?
So there's no specific look. Like I haven't tried to recreate any specific locations. It's more kind of trying to recreate the feeling. Partly just, again, for production reasons, because it's easier to kind of not have to have that constraint.
Yeah.
But also partly because, I mean, the legends themselves are not situated in certainly not situated in time and often not situated in place either, with a few exceptions. I mean, it's kind of, the stories are set in this kind of undefined era of Welsh mythology rather than being this. And as soon as you start putting specific places, you start tying it down to specific locations and specific time periods, right?
Yeah. They say something like, you know, so-and-so who was the king of Gwynedd, or he was the king of Paris. And it's very broad, you know, it's huge masses of land. It could be anywhere in that area. And like you said, it's not that tied to a specific location.
But I do want to capture that feel. So all the references come from, you know, you start on the coast, all the references for the coast come from the Pembrokeshire coastline. So I've got like a whole folder of different beaches and different cliffs and different sections. Actually, in that case, though, there was one specific beach that I didn't try and model it specifically, but, you know, it's almost recognizable. Do you know a Trosaith?
Yeah. Oh, Trosaith.
That one beach has been a very kind of tight reference. You know, that little waterfall that's coming up there.
I was just about to say, have you got the waterfall in there? That's it. Yeah, Trosaith is a pretty famous one.
Yeah, it's not in there yet, but it's on my to-do list of things to add.
Those are kind of our main questions, but is there like a time frame for when this might be out or when people might be able to expect it to be out, or is that still something that's it will be ready when
TBC,
it's
is it?
Yeah, TBC.
Yeah, it's like I can say this year, probably.
That's exciting. That's very exciting.
It's very vague. originally, I was targeting, like when I did the reveal, I was targeting spring this year, but that's not going to happen. So,
The best things take time, mate. The best things take time.
Sometime after spring this year. I think just the amount of reception and the, you know, the excitement and the positivity that came kind of made me have to revise a little bit my own expectations of what I was looking for from the game. It's kind of, you know, people have a lot of, people's expectations are clearly present.
Yeah.
You know, I want to make sure that I can meet as far as I can what people are expecting from it.
I think we found that when we started this, we were just looking for a way for us to, like, we enjoy history and we enjoy catching up. So we did this during lockdown. And we quickly started getting a decent following, and it's just grown and grown. And we think because there's not a huge amount of Welsh content out there, but people really want it. So like the minute you see something like this, like when we saw this, like me and Jack both found this natively when we were like on Reddit or something like that. And we were like, wow, I can't wait for this. Because I think so many people feel Wales has a rich vein of this stuff, but just not a lot of people who go out there and do it. So I bet, yeah, I bet you everyone listening to this will be really keen to check it out once it does come out.
I think culturally, Wales is kind of, it's hot at the moment. You know, you've got Robin Definitely. Ryan doing their thing. You had, what's his name, Michael Sheen doing his your World Cup speech a couple of years ago, which kind of got a lot of people interested.
To be more of a push lately, we've said this a couple of times, haven't we? And like, there's a lot of Welsh noir TV shows out at the moment over here, and they are getting a lot of traction. And there seems to be, there's always one going on.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but in the 90s, there's a thing called Cool Cymru, which is when like Welsh bands were really popular. So, and it was like Stereophonics, Manic Street Preachers, Super Furry Animals. And it was the 90s had quite a big revival for Welsh being cool. That died away a little bit, but in the like the last 15 years, it's like a lot more films being done here, a lot of great actors, a lot of like great bands coming back and things like that. So it does feel like Cymru's having its moment again, which is exciting.
Yeah.
And you're part of their revolution, mate. So we can't thank you enough.
Honestly, I am buzzing for this. I cannot wait.
Me too.
No, same, man. It's like when it's going to be that next one that me and Frank have. Basically, whenever we're playing the same game, we just text about it constantly.
Yeah.
So when this comes out, it's going to be like, where have you got to? I'm only on second branch. Oh, I'm on third branch. Wait till you get to the fourth, mate. You know, it's gonna be that all over.
And will it be a case of like you go exploring, or does the game take you on the narrative that it wants you to follow, so you don't get lost? Or does it give you? Do you go exploring on your own? How does it work in that sense?
So I can tell you about kind of one of the central mechanics of the game here. So firstly, like the narrative itself, the in-game narrative is pretty much the third branch. It's focused entirely on the third branch. During the third branch, you're kind of uncovering things from your history. So like the core narrative is you're Pradali, you've arrived back, you found your kingdom desolated by this magical fog, and you need to work out who, why this fog is there, who did it, how can you undo it? So it's kind of a little bit like a mystery there, but of course the answers to all those questions lie in your past. So you're discovering all these stories from the past, and you know how you were born, how your parents met, how your parents married, because these are the stories that are going to give you the answers to what's going on.
So like,
in the present
you find out about the war in Ireland and everything like that, and with Matholwch and all that stuff. Is it? That's cool.
Yep. And the fog acts as kind of like the main mechanic to push you through the narrative. So the way it works is it's inspired by the Battle Royale kind of wall of death. Mm. So the fog like starts off open and you're completely free to explore the world. But then over time, it closes in on a specific narrative point. So over time, whatever, how much exploring you do, eventually you will have to go to that point. And then once you get to that point, you unlock that piece of narrative, the fog opens up again, you're free to explore, and it closes down on the next narrative point. That's so you're kind of like, you're
That's
forced
good,
to go there.
Good little
so
thing
it's,
there, yeah.
It's kind of, it's trying to find a way to balance between that, you know, letting people explore a little bit of an open world, but still be able to keep them on that kind of narrative trail. And it also lets me do some kind of fun things in terms of pacing and intensity. So there are points at which the fog is just kind of giving you a gentle nudge forward. And there are other points where the fog is like closing as fast as you can run.
It's got a gun to your head type thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got to go this way.
So, you know, you're building a kind of sense of intensity and a little bit of pacing there. So that's how I kind of push the player through the story. But still hopefully giving, you know, a sense of being part of a more open world.
It does. I know you referenced
it
being
like you thought it out, man.
Similar to Firewatch, but I can't think of any game I've played that seems to like to cover what you're covering. So that's really exciting. I genuinely cannot wait for this.
think some of the other reference titles are just well-known and less well-known. Is that what I just said? I don't remember. Less well-known.
That whiskey. That whiskey's getting you.
Yeah.
That whiskey's getting you.
Like another one of the most important references, a game called The First Tree. I heartily recommend it, but it's the same kind of basic structure. You know, you're exploring an environment. There's a little bit of light platforming gameplay, but you're mostly just finding out your own personal history, stories about your family, and stories about a family of foxes at the same time. So you're kind of unlocking these two stories in parallel as you explore. It's a really lovely, pretty game.
I was also going to say, we haven't covered this, or I can't see online where you've mentioned it, but is what platforms would it be on? Is it a laptop, a computer game, or is it on other platforms?
At the moment, purely Steam. That's the only platform I'm developing on at the moment. I would love to be able to bring it to other platforms, but it really depends on the reception for the Steam version. And it's expensive and time-consuming to port a game to other platforms.
Also, Franks, you sounded so, like, not of this generation. Is it a computer game? Is it a computer game? Can I use my mouse and keyboard on it?
Well, I was trying to think, how can I explain this to people who don't play, like, who aren't gamers? And, like, I was trying to think, what's the word? I got stuck with a computer gamer, yes?
Is this for the computer?
Is it on the computer? Sega? Can you play it on the Sega?
Yeah. Oh, it's one of those Nintendos, is it?
And Steam is it's kind of like Amazon for games. It's like where most games are held. So, we'll try and get as many of our listeners to download it, so then it will be available on other platforms maybe one day.
Yes, we'll link the Steam. We'll link the Steam. We'll link it to Steam. Now it's the old guy. We'll link it to the Steam page in the pod notes, so you can go in and you can add it to your wish list. You can do whatever you like. Keep an eye on it, and then when Steven's unveiled his masterpiece, it'll be there, ready to go.
We'll share on our socials.
And please do wishlist it. It's incredibly hard for small indie developers to get exposure. And Steam wishlist is one thing that really makes a huge difference. I mean, any kind of social media support always helps, but the one that actually does have an impact is a Steam wishlist. So please do come on Steam and wishlist on Steam.
Oh, you heard it there, guys.
Yeah, well, I'll make sure that's everything if you listened to an hour of Steve giving us his time, you owe it to him to go and wishlist this. Thank you so much for coming on, mate. This has been a real treat for me and Jack, who, like we said, we're big Welsh history nerd gamers, so this is an absolute delight.
Mate, I'm genuinely buzzing for it. I cannot wait for that to release.
Yeah,
it's been an absolute pleasure, really. I've had a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. Where can people find you? Are you on any social medias? Social medias. What's wrong with me tonight?
Again, what is wrong with you tonight?
You're on that social medias?
Are you on that thing called the internet? The web?
It's going to be big, I promise.
I have been on X, but I'm kind of transitioning over to Blue Sky. I think I'll likely close the X account.
Like a lot of people.
We give it up. We don't do X either.
I'll share the Blue Sky link with you all.
Perfect. Yeah, man, share that with us. We'll link everything in the pod notes anyway. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on, mate. It's been a blast.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks all. Ta-da, ta-da, ta-da.